and technology in our lives. Then throw in some culture, history, ethics, philosophy, and religion. That's Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. The human body is a fragile thing. It has been finely tuned to live on this Earth. But now, humans are beginning to leave the protection of this planet and venture into space. And space is a dangerous place, far from the protection that the Earth provides. Without gravity, and bombarded by radiation, the body begins to suffer. But scientists and engineers are stepping in to understand the short and long-term effects of space on the human body. Today, we are joined by Dr. Ronke Olabisi, a biomedical engineer at Rutgers. She is concerned with repairing and regenerating tissues of the body, especially during spaceflight. So welcome to the podcast, Ronke.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So one of the obvious threats to the human body that is in space is microgravity. So what kind of things does microgravity do to the human body?
It affects every single tissue. It affects every single organ system. So for instance, you think about a balloon filled with water, right? And you think about, and I'm just going to give you one example of the many things it does. If you think about hanging that balloon and it's going to hang like a teardrop, right? Mm-hmm. Filled with water. But if you ever look at a balloon once somebody has thrown it, or a balloon filled with water, once this has been thrown or in midair while it drops, that balloon no longer looks like a teardrop. It looks like a perfect circle. Mm-hmm. And it's because when you're holding it, it's hanging, right? And that fluid is pulling it down. So the gravity is pulling the fluid down to make it into that teardrop. When it's in free fall, everything is falling at the same time. Nobody's pulling on it. So your vascular system is like that. So all of the blood is being pulled down and it wants to go towards your feet, right? And so because of that, you have a different amount of fluid towards your feet than you do towards your heart, right? And so your heart has become accustomed, like everything is designed in gravity. For instance, we have veins in our legs, which are lower than our heart. We have veins everywhere. We don't have any valves in our veins up to here, but we have valves in our veins below our heart, but okay. No valves in our veins leading to our brains.
Okay.
Because gravity is going to do that. And the body knows that gravity is going to do that. So why evolve valves in your veins towards your head? So what happens then is once you're in microgravity, the fluid shifts the same way a balloon would and the same way the balloon wants to become round. So the fluid shifts and it's a headward fluid shift. And so what that results in is now your heart has a lot more fluid in that area and it's you get these receptors saying there's too much fluid. So excrete fluid, excrete fluid, excrete fluid. And so you wind up excreting more fluid than you would need on the Earth. And so what happens is astronauts will pee until the body senses that, okay, this is the same amount of fluid near my heart that I'm used to. But also what happens is they get puffy faces because the fluid's shifted towards their head. They'll have a headache for the first 2 to 5 days in space, like the worst headache you've ever had. And this fluid shift, it changes a lot of things. But most importantly, when they return, they don't have enough fluid in their bodies to maintain blood pressure on Earth. So a lot of times they develop what's called orthostatic intolerance, where they pass out because now all the blood is pulled down. And when pulled down, there's a lot less. And so your head doesn't have as much as it needs. So your head is used to a certain blood pressure and it doesn't. And so you pass out.
Okay.
So it affects that microgravity. Your bones are this really awesome optimization system. And no matter how old you are, your skeleton is at most 10 years old. So you've got this constant turnover and it's constantly repairing little insults. Like if you imagine the tab on a soda, if you bend it back and forth, eventually it pops off, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't want that to happen to your bones. And so that's why they're turning over so that eventually just from walking, you don't break a leg. Now, in microgravity, your bones sense, hey, I'm no longer needed to support weight. So why don't I just resorb myself into nothingness? And so as an example, postmenopausal women lose bone from on the order of about 1 to 3% per year. Astronauts in space lose bone on the order of about 1 to 3% per month. So it's really dramatic. And so some of the ones who have come back with osteopenia, which is just above osteoporosis. Some of them have come back with osteoporosis.
So for these astronauts, if they were to stay in space or if they were to go to Mars and never come back, would they still have these problems or would they adapt to life there?
It only becomes a problem if you return.
Okay.
Maladaptation is when your body is adapting inappropriately to its environment. So their bodies are adapting appropriately to space. It's just that it's maladapted for Earth. So you need that much blood in your blood volume for being on Earth. But in space, it gives you a headache. So it's good that you're excreting this. You really don't need that much bone mass if you're going to live in space forever. But because we're going to return, it becomes a problem because then you can't support your own body weight. You've got osteoporosis. You don't want that.
I imagine another big concern on the human body, whether it be in space or on a different planet, is radiation.
Yes.
And so how does that affect the body?
So still going to find that out. Right, because when we talk about radiation here on Earth, most of the radiation that insults that we've seen have been nuclear radiation, like a single type, like X-ray radiation. You have too much of that, or you have synchrotron radiation, which are where they spin electrons around. But with cosmic radiation, it's a whole bunch of different types. So you can't just say, "We'll put lead around the person and we'll protect them," because there are certain kinds of charged particles that become more dangerous after passing through lead.
Uh-huh.
Like acrylic is what you need to hide behind. And so in the space station, it's in what's called low Earth orbit. So it's still protected by our magnetic shield, by our magnetic field. However, not as much. And so even being protected by the magnetic field, the people in the space station get 40 times more cosmetic radiation than we do here on Earth.
Mm.
When you look at places that have higher elevation, like Denver is a mile high. The higher you go, the less protection you get from the atmosphere because these large particles collide with air before reaching you. So there's higher incidences of cancer in places that are high elevated compared to sea level. So when you think about going to Mars where there is absolutely no magnetic field and you think about it's going to probably be a 3-year round trip, many, 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 many times the cosmetic radiation that you would get here on Earth.
Yeah.
In Earth's atmosphere, and this is, people talk about colonizing Mars and putting an atmosphere back on Mars. The reason Mars doesn't have an atmosphere is because it doesn't have a magnetosphere. And we have a magnetosphere because our core, the core of our planet, is spinning and it creates this beautiful magnetic shield, essentially.
What are people doing to help protect the astronauts right now?
There's a lot of different researchers exploring different countermeasures is what they call them. And countermeasures are ways to avert that. And so they have exercise regimens to avert loss of muscle because they also lose a lot of muscle. Mm-hmm. They have exercise regimens to try to avert the loss of bone, different drug therapies, different diet therapies. People are looking into different kinds of nanotechnology, like a nanospray paint that would have different kinds of nanoparticles that absorb the radiation. So there's the National Space Biomedical Research Institute, and they do a lot of that. NASA does a lot of the research as well. The researchers aren't only located at these places, they're located all across the country and funded by these places.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So moving more now into what you do specifically. So I know that you work a lot on looking at human bone. So how did you get interested in working on bone?
You have a professor in an aerospace class assign a project where you're supposed to design a material for a non-aerospace application. And then you go online and try to come up with an idea and you see a hemp implant and you think it's the coolest thing ever. That's how that happens.
Okay.
And it was. As an engineer, as a mechanical engineer, as an aerospace engineer, you study a lot of materials as part of your job. And it was the first material I had ever encountered that was a composite, like many of the materials we study. And for instance, cement is a composite. It's concrete is made of cement and rebar. And so it's two different materials that add different things. So the rebar adds a little bit of flexibility so that it doesn't crack so easily. and the cement adds the stiffness. The thing about bone was that it was this composite material, just like wood, just like concrete, just like all the things that I'd studied, except it was intelligent. It had sensors, and it said, I don't need to be here, but I need to be there. I can grow in response to this stress. I can reduce myself in response to this stress. And so it was very cool.
I know that you take a look at some natural material to help and to build and regenerate bone. So what are some of these materials that you're using, and why are you using them?
So I'm using hydrogels because they mimic the pre-bone state. So you have like this kind of like jello state before it solidifies. And that's what is called a bony callus. And like if you ever break a bone, first what happens is that jello-like substance will form between the ends of the break. And as long as you keep the ends of both bone ends, if you keep them still, eventually it'll harden. If you don't keep it still, you can form what's called a non-union, and you can have a new joint. Like my mom stubbed her toe so many times and never did anything about it, and now she can turn it completely around. She likes to gross people out with that. So that's why I use hydrogels, because they're like a precursor state. Now, the other thing that I use is nacre, which is the shiny iridescent part on the inside of seashells. Mm-hmm. And it's a really cool story behind it. I love it to death. In 1921, I think, these archaeologists found this Mayan jaw, and stuck in the front mandible, the front three teeth, were nacre shells that had been sculpted to look like teeth. Oh. And they believed, oh, okay, well, this was part of a funerary rite. They didn't want to bury the people without teeth, and so they just had it in a museum. And then in 1971, this dentist, I believe Dr. Bobbio, was like, can I borrow that? Can I x-ray that? And so he x-rayed it, and he found that they had bony ingrowth into the nacre teeth. So you have bony ingrowth into your teeth, and that's what keeps them from you being able to just pull it out. And so 6th century Mayans had better tooth implants than we do today.
Wow, that's fascinating.
We get metal screws that bones don't grow into. You know, and so they put the implant in, and it's a screw, and it's a side. This was straight up biomaterial integrated. And so after that, a whole bunch of French researchers started investigating nacre, and they found that even though nacre is what we call a biomineral, because it's a mineral created by biology, just like bone is a biomineral, even though this biomineral evolved through completely different pathways than bone, it can cause the bone of mammals to respond. The bone cells of mammals will grow towards it. They'll grow into it. They'll start to eat it. They'll be stimulated to grow more. And so they took a tiny chip of nacre and a tiny chip of bone and put it down on top of a bed of bone cells and watched what happened. And these bone cells, these mouse bone cells, started to grow bone from the bone side, but they started to grow something that looked like nacre from the nacre side.
Wow.
How does this happen? It's just fascinating. It doesn't cause an immune response. It's been used as bone implants. They ground up some powder and molded it into a jaw for somebody who was missing their jaw, and it started to regrow it. And so it's just this amazing substance that like we have everywhere because we eat oysters and pearls all the time. And there's tons and tons of nacre that nobody's using that's already present. And so I'm trying to combine nacre with the hydrogels, which are like the jello stuff. And that way give kind of like a scaffold for the cells to do their work and grow on and create bone.
So this would help the astronauts then, and even on Earth. I mean, it doesn't matter where the person is, just help whenever a bone is fractured to help the bone regenerate faster.
Yes, exactly.
As far as other regions of the body, what are some of the diseases you want to take a look at to help cure using these materials?
So I'm looking at wound healing. And recently we made a discovery where we were able to get chronic wounds that took 35 days to heal. We were able to get them to heal in 14 days. And so I can't really talk about how we do that because it's being patented.
Okay.
But I can tell you that it's pretty cool. So it's something that would help because we're looking into, so far it's worked for chronic wounds, and we're looking into seeing whether it would work with radiation burns, which not only would help astronauts should they be, should exposure to radiation of some sort, because you assume that at some point we're going to go to no longer chemical powered, but maybe nuclear or ion powered. Mm-hmm. And if there's radiation involved with that, then there's potential for burns. And so radiation burns are one of the hardest types of burns to manage. There's no gold standard treatment. And if this could help, then it would be great for not only astronauts, but for victims of accidents here on Earth. And also a large percentage of cancer patients undergoing radiation get these terrible radiation burns as a side effect. Okay. And so it would help them too.
Okay. As far as in your eye, I know that you're doing some work on macular degeneration as well, which could cause blindness. So what kind of materials are you looking at to help solve problems within the eye? And how do you do that?
So we're looking at hydrogels again, because within the eye, the reason that that happens is something called the Bruch's membrane. And that is where these retinal pigment epithelial cells live. They sit on it. It just starts to degenerate. Mm-hmm. And if you can replace that, or if you can build a scaffold so that it's no longer degenerating and so that it's just beginning to form a layer of cells, then you don't necessarily get that loss that you see.
Is this something, again, that would help in space? Is there a specific risk in space that targets the eye, or is it mostly for people who are aging or have some sort of diseases?
Well, age-related macular degeneration is the number one cause of blindness in developed countries, and it is age-related. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are problems with vision among astronauts after they've returned. There's a lot of them report vision problems. But it's not necessarily the same etiology. Like, okay. We're not certain why it's happening. People are looking into it. And for the most part, things that happen in space, they're just like a faster model of what's going to happen on the Earth anyway. Whatever we learn from that, we learn how to apply it to people who are suffering the same thing on Earth.
You're also interested in this work on a thing called 100-year Starship?
Yes. The goal is to promote the development and research and all the tools that we would need to make it to another star in 100 years. And it's not important that we actually do it. If you think about all of the advances that came about when we went to the moon, mm-hmm. they needed a way to communicate with the astronauts. And so communication satellites were developed. As a direct result, we have cell phones, we have GPS, we have satellite TV, we have satellite radio. Without the effort to go to the moon, those weren't needed. Like, people were fine with landlines. It's one of those things, like, the challenge makes you come up with things. They needed filtered water because they had to filter the water that they were recycling. And today we have Brita. Today we have all of these life straws that can be distributed to people in developing countries where they don't have potable water because it's got bacteria. We didn't have insoles for shoes. They developed those so that the astronauts would be comfortable walking on the moon. We did not have cordless drills. Obviously, there was no place for them to plug their, you know, so we have lots of cordless tools because of that. And so, like, if you think about the way we, as scientists and engineers, we want to take a complex problem and simplify it into the simplest form that it can go. And from there, we can design based on that simple problem. And if you look at a spacecraft as a small version of Earth, like, you only have what you brought with you, you don't have any more resources than what you have, you got to figure out a way to recycle it all. I mean, those are all the problems that we have on Earth. And so that's why a lot of the things that are applicable to us today and are useful to us today was because they were looking at those problems back then. Like, back then in the 60s, they didn't really care about recycling, you know, but now we care about it. And a lot of the stuff that we learned from going to the moon is very applicable because it was a smaller problem, smaller model of Earth. This was 10 years. Like, they decided in 61 that they were going to go, and they went in 69. So if we decided 100 years before, like in 1869, they didn't think that was ever possible. But if they had decided, okay, 100 years, we'll go to the moon, what kind of things would have come out? I mean, thousands of patents that have come out. So what kinds of things would have come out if they had decided that? So if we decide, let's just pretend it's possible. What do we need to get there? Okay, well, it would help to have, let's say, suspended animation. Okay, well, what populations on Earth could that help? Well, let's say you have an incurable disease and you don't want to die. Well, I'll put you in suspended animation. Or let's say you can't perform the surgery right now because it's going to take time to find a donor, but you're going to die. Okay, let's put you in suspended animation. Like this has real medical applications on Earth.
Right.
There are so many different things. Like if we could find a propulsion system that would get us even faster than what we're doing now, we can even just explore our own solar system. Like we haven't gone past the moon. You know, what else is out there? What can we learn? And what we learn from the attempt will improve life on Earth. And to say that is not conjecture. That's how it's always happened. Like we found cures for salmonella because of the space station. We have Invisalign braces because they needed invisible materials to cover their antenna. We have ear thermometers because they wanted to measure the radiation of stars. It's transformative. Yeah, check us out. 100yearstarship.org, 100yss.org.
Right. A lot of the technologies that we found because we went to space, a lot of the technologies you're working on as well, I mean, they're applicable for people going to space or going to the moon or going to Mars, but they're also applicable for people who are suffering with some of those issues here on Earth.
Exactly.
So when people are asking about what is 100 Year Starship, I guess a lot of people might say, oh, this is kind of a crazy idea to be able to go on an interstellar mission within 100 years. And so I guess your argument is more that it's not important whether or not we go.
Right.
It's important to just start thinking of that way. And that way we start pushing ourselves as a society to explore exactly. That we haven't been exploring all that much recently.
Exactly. And when you think about like every time exploration has happened, inventions have come. Everywhere you go, there are stories of inventions. You have different needs. And when you have different needs, it spurs invention to meet those needs. But if you're just going about your business in the every day and you're like, I have everything I need, you're not going to invent anything.
Right. Yeah. And I think it goes much beyond needs. I mean, there are people who are willing to sign up for a one-way trip to Mars, even if they know they'll die there. But yes. For them, it's much more important than just, you know, what the needs that they have of their life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcasts. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, head over to sparkdialogue.com/love and see ways that you can share the love and help this podcast grow. And we'd also love to hear from you. What do you like about this podcast, or what would you like to hear more about? Finally, you can find us at sparkdialogue.com, on Twitter at sparkdialogue, and on facebook.com/sparkdialogue. As always, thanks for listening.